Hi, and welcome to another episode of Rational Actors on Blogging Heads. I'm Kevin Glass, managing editor of townhall.com, and today I'm joined by...
I'm Zoe Carpenter with The Nation magazine.
Yeah, well, thanks for being on with me, Zoe. We've got a couple different topics that we want to get to today. But first, the issue that has probably been dominating the news cycle and the DC reporter scene and the Wonka sphere and all of that for the past few weeks, which is the rollout of Obamacare. And I've written a bit about this, and you've written a bit about this, but what I want to kind of try and find some ground between us here on is that I want to ask you if you think there are conservatives who are making criticisms of Obamacare right now who are doing so in good faith and have legitimate points to be made.
I'm sure there are some out there, but they're not dominating the conversation. I think there are people on the left, too, who are raising legitimate concerns about the rollout and especially the technical issues. But I think, by and large, the complaints and the concerns that are getting the most airtime are not in good faith. And a lot of it is threaded with misinformation. So I think that's something to be wary of when we're seeing stories about people getting kicked off their plans, for example.
Now, let me try and explain what I would see as the, let's say, coherent, legitimate, and smart conservative criticism of Obamacare, and let me see if you buy this.
Sure.
Basically, so we had a lot of people on the left, before all the healthcare stuff went down, pushing for a single-payer system, and that largely is not very popular with the American people because... one of the things that it would do is it would disrupt the healthcare system to a much larger degree than what we're seeing right now. And we might end up with a better system at the end, but the kind of nightmare of Americans losing their insurance, not having access to the same doctors, et cetera, would largely be the same under, you know, a move to a single-payer system. So the point of Obamacare was to try and preserve as much of our private health insurance system while expanding access as much as possible. And to do that, I would say that President Obama and kind of the healthcare experts that he has in charge built this almost Rube Goldberg machine where everything kind of has to work perfectly. And if any kind of small part of that starts to falter, the whole system might fall apart. And that's what we're seeing with, you know, the website rollout. And President Obama said, you know, Obamacare is not just a website. There's a whole lot to the law. And that's true. But if you can't get the people signed up for health insurance that you need to be signed up, the whole thing might fall apart. You know, if the young, healthy people don't sign up, and right now with an unworkable website and, you know, we've also seen signing up by phone isn't exactly reliable either. You can't get the young, healthy people signed up. Premiums spike, which causes, you know, fewer young, healthy people to want to sign up, and the whole system kind of falls apart.
Okay, so there are lots of things to unpack there. One is that just because the healthcare website is almost unworkable right now, that doesn't indicate that it's going to be that way, you know, in a month or certainly in 3 months. If it does persist for more than a month, I think some of those spiraling concerns that you're raising would certainly be an issue, but I think it's a little bit too early to throw up our hands and declare disaster at this point. Certainly a PR disaster, but I don't think we've come to a functional disaster yet in terms of the long-term success of the law. About rate shock, a lot of those claims have been extremely inflated by ignoring or downplaying the effects of subsidies. And then as to your point about the disruption of the healthcare system is terrible. I don't think there are many people who would argue that we have a functional system. And so, yes, there are disruptions. And single payer, as you say, would have been an even greater disruption. But that doesn't seem to be a compelling case for maintaining the status quo at all, because the status quo leaves millions of people locked out of the market.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I don't think that, well, certainly I would agree with you that there are conservative critics of President Obama and the healthcare law who have no particular interests and never had any particular interest in seeing improvements or changes made to the healthcare system, either to expand access, which is the primary goal of Obamacare, or try and tamp down costs, which is the part of Obamacare that we're going to have to see a little bit of change on in the future. And obviously, you know, we can't declare it a failure yet. And people who have are being disingenuous. I would agree with you there. But if the it looks like from the reporting, you know, that the sign-up process is not anywhere close to where it needs to be. And it basically needs to be at 100% by December 15th, because you need that, you need December 15th as a drop-dead date so that people can maintain coverage starting January 1st next year. And we've seen the Obama administration maybe start to relax rules on eligibility and the penalty for 2014, but that's still, you know, a huge concern that they need to get right. So, you know, they have a little bit of leeway here, and obviously there have been previous cases where insurance reform has not gone completely according to schedule. So, yes, the Obama administration needs some leeway, but I do think that they deserve to take some criticism on how it's gone so far.
Sure, and I think that's fair. We can criticize the technical rollout, but I think that that raises the question: if you're going to criticize the technical rollout, why go beyond that? Why does that become a justification for trying to tear down the whole law? And what's the alternative? You seem to have serious hesitations about the full feasibility of this law, so I would ask, what's your proposal for a healthcare system that can really provide benefits to people with pre-existing conditions and people who can't afford to get into the private market themselves right now?
Yeah, that's right. And certainly, you know, I think that conservatives need to kind of step out of the way on this. And we've seen stories of trying to suppress, you know, Obamacare navigators in the states, which I think is a really bad choice for Republicans right now. Mm-hmm. Because I think that the best criticism Republicans and conservatives can make is that, and this was the case when the law was being debated, is that if the law works perfectly, it still might be a disaster, right?
Sure.
If they try, you know, the mandate isn't strong enough to incentivize young, healthy people to sign up. I think that a lot of people would agree with that. The mandate is much stronger in Massachusetts, and that might be partly why that system works. And it, you know, as currently constructed, I think a lot of conservatives made the case that even under perfect working conditions, costs are going to be much higher under the Affordable Care Act than they were under, you know, the status quo.
I don't think that's been borne out by in the statistics yet. Can you elaborate on that? Because we've seen costs go down slightly, and the projections are that will continue.
So there's a distinction to be made between health costs, which are at the heart of a lot of problems right now, and a distinction to be made between what the cost of actual insurance is. And the subsidies affect this as well. So I think that conservatives would, and I think that what progressives have actually trumpeted is that the prices that we're seeing for insurance in a lot of the state exchanges right now are below what projections were going to be. Mm-hmm. I would say that conservatives would say that those projections were pretty terrible, and that for a lot of people, those projections and what we're seeing right now are a large jump in what we could have. And the Manhattan Institute actually compiled a list that I think that they completed yesterday, because kind of compiling all of the information on how much premiums cost in every state. I think it's something like 45 states saw a year-over-year increase in insurance premiums. And that's not to say that insurance premiums wouldn't have increased anyway under, you know, even a status quo system. But in a lot of places, they're significantly higher. You're seeing 50, 100% premium increases.
But that's not taking into account the subsidies.
Right.
Which are significant. If you leave that out, you're being totally disingenuous.
So
how can you argue that it makes any sense mathematically to not include the subsidies in those comparisons? Because that's going to be the total cost to the consumer, is including the subsidies that are available.
That's the cost to the consumer, yes. I think a lot of people would argue that subsidies are just passed along to the pockets of insurance companies, right? You subsidize something, you get more of it.
No, but it's the government subsidizing it, not the insurance companies. So yes, you could have an argument then about the fundamental question of redistribution, if you want to have that argument, but it's not about the cost to consumers.
Well, the cost to consumers is certainly one aspect of it, but the total price of insurance, I think, also has to be an aspect of it. And so, yes, for a lot of people who are shopping in the individual market, they're seeing premiums come down. But, you know, the basic nature of how welfare cliffs work is that once you get out of the subsidy market, you're going to see fairly large out-of-pocket increases to consumers. The San Francisco Chronicle, I think, and I wrote about this, found a, you know, 62-year-old couple who live in San Francisco, live on $60,000 a year, have no eligible age children, and they're seeing their insurance, I think, jump by 60 or 70%. And that's a fairly large amount for people in their age demographic.
Okay, now, so we have those kind of anecdotal stories, but if you look overall, those things don't bear out as being a huge percentage of the population.
Right, and it's really hard to get information on who will get subsidized and where that will fall.
Well, actually, we know that about only 3% of the population will or may face higher premiums because they have to go to newer plans. So we do have those stats.
Yes, we know. Well, we know who won't be eligible. We know the percentage of the population who won't be eligible for subsidies. We're not sure yet how many people fall under which subsidy category if their out-of-pocket costs are going to be higher. But aside from that, I do think that it is, and conservatives, I would say, do think that the unsubsidized cost of insurance is still important, because you're seeing, you know, before Obamacare, we didn't have a national minimum benefit standard, and progressives would probably say that was a bad thing, and it might have been a bad thing. But now that we've seen, you know, obviously HHS has to set minimum standards for enrolling in these exchanges. And some of those things are pieces of insurance that some people will never use. Like, if I were, and I'm married, so this is not the case, but if I were a bachelor for the rest of my life, I don't need maternity care. But any insurance policy that I'm going to go buy on the exchange is going to include maternity care in it. Now, in effect, that's a form, like you said, of redistribution. It's that women face naturally higher health costs by mere fact of their being born women. And maybe that's not fair, and we need to have redistribution from in terms of health insurance costs from men to women. But that wasn't made explicit kind of when we were debating the whole package back in 2009 and 2010. So I do think that the unsubsidized cost of insurance matters, at least as much as the out-of-pocket cost to the consumer.
Okay. I just don't think that those kinds of concerns match up with the millions of people who have been locked out of the market. So, yes, there are people, there are insurance plans that will cost more. That's true. But, and... you know, you may be subsidizing someone else's maternity care. But I think that if we weigh them on the scale, neither of them necessarily are completely fair. We're not going to get that. And so I think that we have to make a choice as a society about whether we are going to keep millions out of the market, totally denied care, or if we're going to raise costs a bit for a small percentage of people. And I do understand that for some people that might be a hardship. And I hope that there are ways to continue to explore how to improve the law, but I think that it's I think we're kind of at a dead end if we just criticize the law on those merits without really acknowledging the trade-offs that have to be made in any kind of legislation that's this big and that's trying to tackle a problem that's this big.
Right. And I think that there's a kind of, you get to a loggerheads at a certain point, and that is that the point of Obamacare, and this was said explicitly by administration officials, was to expand access to care, you know, decrease the number of uninsured by as much as possible while kind of trying to preserve our status quo healthcare system as much as possible, to have the least amount of disruption. Mm-hmm. Most conservatives aren't, and I want to make this distinction too, they call it universal coverage, but we're still going to be in an ACA environment at 94 or 95% insured. So we're going to have 5 to 6% of the population uninsured by the time the whole thing is implemented and up and running. And that's it was a fairly large increase in the number of people who will be insured, and that is a good thing, you know, and that is the point of the law. Conservatives would say that the cost of insurance and the cost of care itself, independent of insurance, but the cost of care itself, should be the number one public policy goal. And to a certain extent, to a large extent, that's a much harder thing to tackle because we're not wholly sure how to keep down healthcare costs. But conservatives don't really prescribe to the we need to expand access to insurance as much as possible school of thought. And it's kind of the ACA solution is expand access first, tackle costs later. And the conservative wonks who, you know, don't have all that much cachet in the Republican Party, unfortunately, because the Republican Party largely doesn't listen to their wonks or care all that much about healthcare policy in general, would have said, tackle costs first, and then access will come naturally after that.
Right. Well, the good thing is that there are cost-controlling effects that the Affordable Care Act does have, and we are starting to see costs go down, and I think that we will still see that. So hopefully both of those goals, expanding access to care and lowering the costs of insurance and of medical care in general, will slowly get worked out.
Yes, that's true. Obamacare does have a fair number of kind of, and because, like I said, it's really hard to identify what will definitely control healthcare costs in the future. Obamacare does have some experiments, we'll call them, in attempting to hold down healthcare costs.
Well, rewarding providers who have good outcomes, for an example. That's a significant measure that could have an impact. Prioritizing preventative care so that we can get people to stay healthy rather than treating them afterwards. That's a cost-saving mechanism. So there are lots of things like that that we can point to.
Right. And this is actually, I think, a point of contention. One of the minimum standards that HHS set for, you know, the definition of insurance is that they have to cover a very wide swath of preventative care, exams and tests and screenings and things like that. But I think that you would find actually that a lot of the academic literature would say that a lot of preventative care is kind of wasteful care. And
I disagree entirely. I don't think you would find that. I think that you would find most health providers and public health practitioners see that preventative care is hugely important around the world, not just in the U.S.
I don't know about around the world, but yeah.
There are so many things that fall into the category of preventative care.
Right.
Clean water, you could consider preventative care, rather than treating everyone for dysentery later. So, I mean, it makes sense to build those preventative care into our systems, whether it's health systems or other infrastructure.
It depends on your definition of preventative care. I would say yes, obviously clean water is a huge, hugely important thing for anyone around the world's, you know, long-term health. I think that you'd see that what I'm talking about with preventative care is what's referred to as premium medicine. People who go in for screenings that aren't cost-effective, you know, even in Obamacare, getting back to the actual, the sex redistribution, is that I don't believe that prostate screenings for men in the 50 to 60 demographic are covered or are mandated to be covered, because HHS determined that prostate screenings in that age demographic aren't cost effective. And I think that a lot of health experts would say there are a lot of tests done in the United States nowadays that aren't cost effective, unnecessary MRIs, unnecessary CAT scans, things like that.
Sure. I agree that we could look at some of those things, but if you're talking about cancer screenings or birth control or something like that, those are just no brainers.
That might be the case. I don't have the data on cancer screenings actually. Now, I think that we've come to maybe a loggerheads here, but I hope that I've convinced you of maybe some conservatives who are legitimately concerned about the state of our healthcare system post Obamacare. But I want to get to something that's really interesting, and you wrote a piece for I believe The Nation, the magazine, on a Committee to Protect Journalists report on the Obama administration and how the Obama administration has been really terrible, as a matter of fact, when it comes to press freedoms. And I want you to kind of explain where you're coming from on this and how, you know, this is something that both journalists and the public at large should be concerned about.
Sure. So the fact that the Committee to Protect Journalists issued this report at all is significant because this is the first comprehensive assessment of press freedoms in the U.S. ever. They've been looking at press freedoms and retaliation against journalists in other countries for several decades now, but the fact that this is the time that they choose to examine press freedoms in the U.S. is really significant. And what they found after conversations with dozens of journalists and editors and government officials was that this administration has not only tried to aggressively control information and to control the press, but has been more successful at doing so than other administrations. I think you could argue that every single president has made an effort to control the narrative. That's normal. But the success with which the Obama administration has spread a chilling effect is really significant.
Now, that's really interesting. How exactly has the Obama administration, you know, I mean, you said almost every every administration, to a certain extent, tries to control the narrative, tries to influence the press. How has the Obama administration succeeded where others have failed?
Well, one way is the aggressive prosecution of leakers. So disturbing the relationship, the normal reporter-source relationship. We've had more than twice as many prosecutions under the Espionage Act than any other administrations, than all other administrations combined. And then other attempts to discourage reporters and government officials from working together, such as policies that force government employees to report on one another. And now journalists are reporting that the only people they're ever able to speak to within government agencies or the administration are PR personnel. So they're not actually able to speak to experts on the stories that they're reporting on, just the PR people. And that creates a real issue for reporters trying to do their work. And it also is a significant issue in terms of whistleblowing and accountability reporting, not only in questions of national security, but in sort of normal bureaucratic fraud and waste, or I shouldn't call it normal, but things that aren't related to national security. Some other measures would be the use of internally generated media to supplant outside media coverage. So the Obama administration is extraordinarily tech savvy, healthcare.gov aside. But in terms of using Twitter and Facebook and government websites to spread information, so it makes it seem like the administration is very transparent. And that information is all great as long as it's being used as a supplement to normal press coverage. But this report from CPJ says that, in fact, it's been used to supplant outside reporting. And that really blurs the line between what's reporting and what's propaganda if it's all coming from an internal source.
Right. Now, you said, you know, most journalists now, and the Obama administration has basically put this chilling effect, I guess, on executive agencies. Most journalists have to go through, like you said, communications people or PR people. Is it the prosecution of leakers that's preventing people from going off the record or being quoted as anonymous sources if journalists do want to kind of go around the their communications people?
Right, exactly. If people who would be interested in speaking to journalists, even just to give context, are worried that they're going to be prosecuted, they're less likely to agree to speak to journalists. And if the government is going after journalists and subpoenaing them for the name and information about their sources, then sources can become even less confident that journalists will protect them if the journalists are targeted. So there's just this attempt to really break up the communications between the leakers and, or not even leakers, just people who want to speak with the press and unauthorized and the journalists.
So it's a way, I guess, of controlling the narrative, forcing the press to go through the PR people, right?
Exactly. So the only information that gets out is sanctioned.
Right. So that, you know, if a journalist talks to, say, an HHS expert, that HHS expert doesn't undermine whatever the official line is.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Now, what can journalists do in this environment to kind of combat these press, I guess, freedom attacks from the Obama administration?
Well, I think one of the issues is that the Obama administration doesn't necessarily see this as an issue. So I think media organizations and journalists need to keep the pressure on, keep making it clear that there is strong opposition to these policies and that it really does prevent normal working relationships within the media industries. And then also there is legislation like the Media Shield Law that would protect journalists from being forced to reveal information about their sources. However, that legislation has some significant loopholes in it for national security reporters. So the people who really need that protection may not actually, in fact, be covered by it. And there's also a question about whether we should even be defining who a journalist is in order to give them protection. Perhaps we should instead cover the act of journalism and protect anyone who is engaged in acts of journalism. So that legislation is pending in the Senate right now, and it remains to be seen what will happen with it.
The Shield Law would do that, right? It would define who a journalist is.
Yes, it does. The House version defines the act of journalism, and so advocates, press freedom advocates, see that as the stronger shield. The Senate version has a definition of a journalist, but it does have an important exception for a judge to apply the protections to anyone who they believe warrants the protections, even if they don't actually meet the definition of journalist as laid out in the law.
Because I know that's been a very large area of concern, because we've seen legislators basically have been very ignorant of kind of the act of journalism. And I've seen, I can't name names off the top of my head, but representatives or senators, you know, I guess derogatorily referring to people as bloggers, journalists who don't necessarily have a print publication, who work solely online. Some of these legislators don't really buy that kind of the democratization of journalism that's happened in the internet age and want to say, you know, these 20 print publications are journalists and everyone else, you're on your own.
Absolutely. I think that it's been a big shift in the industry going from these big institutionalized media empires, which still exist, but then we also have a much broader constellation of bloggers and freelancers and people who are using multimedia, and we really should have legislation that is contemporary with that reality.
Right. Now, to a certain extent, this, to me, is kind of a continuation of a long tradition in, I think, American politics that is kind of concentrating power in the executive branch, and having the executive branch be increasingly hostile to transparency. Do you see that as kind of a narrative, or do you think that this is almost a Obama administration specific thing, and it's something that might get reversed in future administrations?
I think that it's certainly not unique to the Obama administration. I think it's more tied to the emergence of the post 9/11 surveillance and security state. This serious interest in controlling the narrative and controlling leaks, that's all connected to a broader effort to just control information in general. But at the same time, to extend surveillance across American citizens. So it's very much tied in to that. And these policies, a lot of them, began during the Bush administration, and the Obama administration has inherited them and boosted them significantly. But it's not alone the brainchild of the administration. And in many ways, it's just machinery that's been set in motion and allowed to keep going. And so it is possible that its gears could be jammed, but I think it would have to be part of a much more deliberate attempt to confront the changes that have happened since 9/11.
Right. And we certainly saw kind of a tightening of executive branch, I guess, attempts to control the narrative during the Bush administration with, obviously, the Scooter Libby affair, the Valerie Plame affair, and now...
the Iraq War.
Well, yes, certainly a lot of the Iraq War, the Bush administration attempted to control the narrative as well through kind of back-alley Pentagon channels. But yeah, the I think that it looked like President Obama ran on trying to repudiate a lot of that closing of transparency of the Bush administration hasn't really lived up to that promise.
I think that's true. We have new government websites that publish more information, and we do have, executive orders trying to stop the excessive classification of documents, and he's given more interviews than other presidents have in the past, and those steps are good, but they don't at all make a complete push for transparency, and they are, I think, more than matched in the other direction by the effort to chill the environment for journalists.
Right. All right, well, I think that's all we have today. Thanks a lot for being on with me, Zoe. I think that we had a productive and interesting and informative, hopefully, conversation. And I would encourage everyone to read your piece in The Nation. It was very interesting.
Great. Well, thanks for having me.